Incumbent Atlantic Beach mayor and two city commissioners hit the road after an election night sweep from female challengers. Governor Rick Scott has a friend in the Florida Supreme Court, as his power to reassign death penalty cases is upheld, and the Duval County School Board plans to join a lawsuit against state lawmakers. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Ryan Bank in for Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect is always live on the radio, and you can subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. Just ahead, all the top stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a question, comment, complaint? You know what to do. Call 549-2937. Then later, how you can take in the Spanish flair of St. Augustine this September. Plus singer-songwriter Jenny Reed, all of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and it's time for our weekly media roundtable as we welcome Dan Scanlon, reporter for the Florida Times-Union.
Good morning.
Jacksonville Business Journal editor Timothy Gibbons.
Good to be here.
A.G. Gankarski with Florida Politics.
Hello.
And Folio Weekly editor Claire Goforth.
Howdy.
Good morning, all. And again, howdy. And good morning, Yeehaw. All. The number is 549-2937. Lots to discuss this Friday, from Rick Scott v. State Attorney Aramis Ayala to local school boards v. the legislature. But our top story, women rule in Atlantic Beach as male incumbents get kicked to the curb by voters. After a fractious, mudslinging election battle, former FBI agent Ellen Glasser emerged as the queen of the mountain, defeating incumbent Mitch Reeves and another challenger, Milton Hall. Glasser teaches criminology at the University of North Florida. So, Claire, we'll start with you. You wrote a pretty lengthy piece about this race and kind of connected it to what seems to be a history of pretty dirty politics in Atlantic Beach and the beaches area more broadly. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, you know, this particular race saw Glasser v. Reeves emerge as essentially a cage match between these two, where at one minute someone from, you know, arguably his camp is filing a complaint that she doesn't meet the residency requirement. The next minute she's filing an ethics complaint that he's been unfairly benefiting from his role as mayor due to some contracts for a company that he works for being awarded to it. And, you know, the beaches politics, it is a pretty it's kind of a cesspool. I think that's true of politics everywhere in general. This race was interesting because we saw three female newcomers beat the incumbents. The newcomers are also seen as more liberal, whereas the incumbents were establishment Republicans. Some people are starting to wonder if this is going to be a precursor to what's going to happen in 2018 when the voter turnout may go against these longstanding conservative incumbents that have held their seats for so long.
A.G. Gankarski, you wrote a piece specifically looking at the connections between some of these political strategists that were hired by these campaigns and the connections they had to our own mayor here in Jacksonville. Can you tell me a little bit about that and why you think that played such a role in this?
Yeah, let me break this down into pieces. The mayor's team was not actually running Mitch Reeves' campaign. That was being run by Burt Ralston. And, Meredith O'Malley Johnson was on the other side running the Democratic campaign. That was one thing. The mayor's team got involved in the last minute. They did a mail piece with the mayor endorsing Mitch Reeves, saying he's a trusted partner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That, according to internal polling I heard about, took the margin from 20 points to where it ended up around 12 points. There are questions as to whether the mayor should have used any political capital at all, even on a pro forma endorsement such as the mail piece endorsement for Reeves. It was kind of a loyalty thing, sort of like with Angela Corey in 2016, where Curry endorsed Corey, but, you know, it didn't really matter and he didn't make it matter. Interesting to note, Curry also backed the candidate Rick Baker down in St. Petersburg. He's expected to win the mayoral race outright there. Instead, he's in a runoff against the incumbent. So it was an 0-for-2 night for Curry's political committee. It was kind of a rear setback for him.
Timothy Gibbons, there is a couple of business connected stories too. We saw an issue with the Beaches Diner and something that the city commission had approved, a gate gas station off of Atlantic Boulevard. And that sort of took center stage here too. And some voters actually took Mitch Reeves' reaction to the backlash that he got pretty hard. Can you explain a little bit about that?
I don't know how much I can go into detail on it, but it is interesting to see those local issues that end up seeming parochial, that end up having kind of an outsized effect, where you have voters know what they want and they see somebody in power doing something that clearly they feel is against their interest, and it pops up as, you know, as a major issue in an election like this.
Our number is 549-2937. What do you think about the Atlantic Beach race and campaign? What do you think about Beach's politics in general? Give us a call, 549-2937. Dan Scanlon, of course, you mentioned before we went on the air that one of the interesting sort of viral things that came out of this was the Beach Diner's one-word response to the election.
Karma.
Right, exactly. So can you explain a little bit about why?
No, I saw that certainly within a few hours of that happening. It was all over Facebook and Twitter. And I guess, obviously, if you don't want a large gas station parked in front of your restaurant, as government has allowed, and he's been fighting, the owner of a very vocal owner of Beaches Diner has been fighting that for quite a while, I guess if he sees the incumbents that he was fighting with out the door, it is karma. It is maybe a new future. Maybe there can be something done to give him back his parking.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing that happens in a small town. Mm-hmm. You've got 3,000 voters, a city of 10,000 people. People are voting according to issues like that, very community-driven issues. And I know conservative Republicans out there who voted for the females who won the election precisely, you know, because they were outraged by the Beach Diner gate imbroglio and the way that the mayor played it.
Beach Diner gate just sounds like the worst, you know, gate scandal ever.
Beach Diner Gazi.
It's interesting though when AG talked about the mayor using political capital. It's interesting to almost wonder why someone would bother when that's not what most people are voting on in an election like this. They're voting on those hyper-local issues, and even if the person wins, it's not like you get anything back from spending that political capital. Now, Jacksonville City government, Duval County government has to deal with a mayor in place there who was not endorsed. So we'll be interested to see how that plays out, you know, having a partner who is not someone who's been described as a loyal partner.
It's going to work out. I mean, it's got to. I mean, the interlocal agreements are set. They are what they are. The mayor has done a better job than Alvin Brown did reaching out to the Beaches. And, you know,
Beaches the Baldwin.
You know, he does reach out to, people from across party lines, too. That's one of the mayor's specialties. I mean, is it something that lasts, that works, like, perpetually for him? No, but he does reach out. And it's something that, you know, he's seen benefit in the last couple of years, at least on council. I'm sure he'll build relationships accordingly now.
Well, we've got some calls coming in, and we'll get to them as soon as possible. Our number is 549-2937. Claire Goforth, is it true, then, that potholes and cracks in sidewalks don't have a political affiliation, that people were voting not based on their political leanings necessarily in this election? And maybe that explains a little bit why you saw such a wave in the opposite direction.
You know, we do often align ourselves Republican or Democrat, and we just dig our heels into the sand. But when it comes down to it, people care about issues. People care about the Beaches Diner. It's a beloved institution at the beach, and everybody has fond memories probably that lives out there of sharing breakfast or lunch with family members over the course of their lifetimes. And when, you know, you let the big business come in and take away the parking spots of the small business that's beloved in a community, that makes people transcend political lines. And they say, no, this is enough is enough. You know, I don't care so much about whether or not you endorse Donald Trump now. I don't want to lose my favorite place to have breakfast, if that is their favorite.
Most potholes are a member of the Bull Moose Party. They're traditionalists.
You guys, okay, wow, I didn't know that. You learn something new with Tim Gibbons on the air every day. It looks like these were, just to put this in perspective, AG, you mentioned there's what, like 3,000 total voters in Atlantic Beach,
yes. I mean,
give or take?
This eyeball, 3,000 out of 10,000, got a 30% turnout, give or take, for that election, which
right.
is strong turnout. And if turnout had been more depressed, if You know, the issue of the zoning and, you know, Mitch Reeves' perceived corruption and all these other issues didn't come into play. Well, and it did become a perception issue after a while. It's like you had a certain amount of voters just like, well, this mayor's shady. We got to get rid of him.
Right. And Glasser won with 54.27% of the total votes, which was only winning by 365 mm-hmm. votes. We've got a call
that's
now.
New turnout is what I'm saying.
Right. Yeah. We've got a call now. Don in Atlantic Beach. Don, you're on the air.
I just wanted to make sure you guys focused on, I think, a large issue in this election that had not been pressed forward very much was the corruption of Mitch Reeves. Twice he had been accused of doing business with the city while he was the mayor. And one of the interesting parts of it was he actually changed companies that he worked for while he was mayor, and the city changed with him and started buying from the new company he worked for. That wasn't brought out very clearly during the election, but I think was a huge part of it. It's an undercurrent. And many of the people I talked to were very versed on it, so it didn't come out in the press very strong. I think we'll see it in the future, though.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Don.
I'll take my answer off the air.
I appreciate your thoughts on that. So who wants to take that? I think it was a contract about $18,000.
It was. While he was mayor, about $18,000 went to that company. You know, in this case, he was ultimately cleared but by outside counsel. But at the same time, there was the appearance of impropriety. And that can be just as problematic from an ethical standpoint for a politician.
Perception as reality, Dan Scanlon, is that an issue here? As somebody who's lived in the Jacksonville area for around 30 years.
Since we have the beachies and the townies, I think a lot of people don't realize that Atlantic Beach is probably the most idyllic and the most residential of the three beaches communities. Mm-hmm. There's so many little enclaves of beautiful homes and beautiful streets, even where their city hall and police department
is. It has Post Tavern. That's all that matters
just,
for me.
I understand that, but it's just so much of an idyllic park-like atmosphere. So the residents, the people want to keep what they've got. They want to keep that classic Florida beaches look. They don't want Jacksonville Beach's industry and Beach Boulevard. I mean, so I can understand why they would fight to change things if they thought there was any threat to that residential enclave that they've got out there.
Tim Gibbons, do you think that this has anything to do with the larger narrative of like what Dan is saying, kind of large business versus local businesses, these small mom and pop shops? Is it like a losing fight? I mean, are they just trying? Is it a war of attrition here?
I'd go out on a limb and say that big business will always win in the end, but writ largely. But no, I mean, in these local communities, when people care about these issues, it's that idea of going to City Hall and taking your government back that people do have a desire to have their communities be what they want them to be, and it's why we have elections.
And we've got some more calls on the line. We're going to get to them in just a moment here. 549-2937 is the number to call if you want to be part of the conversation. AG, I think it bears noting also the traditional politics of the beaches are sort of different than other beaches areas in Florida, in that, for instance, I'm from Miami, and I know that the beaches area in Miami are usually the most progressive, they're the most liberal, but there is a very strong conservative pillar here in the beaches areas that we have here in Northeast Florida. Can you shed some light on that?
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of it's, you know, they're throwback communities. I mean, it's been talked about on this panel. They're basically small towns. They were kept immune from, you know, the consolidation, you know, experiment in many ways, in that they didn't lose their localism. So they have their local structure. I mean, this is how this election happened, is that, you know, local people responding to local issues. And, you know, it didn't matter if somebody sent out an endorsement or whatever, or the chamber waited in or whoever. You know, the fact is locals were seeing these issues. And, you know, people who, you know, live in the beaches see it as home. People grow up in the beaches see it as home, even they move away. So you have that hometown investment. And, you know, I think that leads to a higher level of civil engagement, not just in an election like this, but generally.
It's an interesting thing when you look at Jacksonville post-consolidation, and generally speaking, most people think that consolidation was a generally good thing for Jacksonville. But what it did lose was the idea that, you know, we would have a South Side neighborhood, or you could have a downtown neighborhood. If that was a city by itself, politics would be different. Well, you wouldn't have downtown Jacksonville residents trying to do something that Beaches residents just don't care about. The Beaches don't have that, as AG pointed out. They have that localism. And it would be interesting to see what Jacksonville's politics would be like if there was more of that here.
And let's go to some of your calls. Steve is in Jacks Beach. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I don't think that Curry's involvement and political capital played a big role in the defeat of these incumbents. I do think Gate was a major factor, and we're still going to have the Gate built, but at the same time, those people who went in favor of it, claiming that they didn't want to be sued, lost their positions in the government. But the other roles were the building of McMansions throughout Atlantic Beach. People are tired of it. They're tired of losing their tree canopy. They're tired of seeing the little town Atlantic Beach turned into something akin to Sea Island and that sort of thing. The other thing was a PAC sent out two mailers, and it's PAC out of Tallahassee that sent out two mailers attacking Ellen Glasser on very spurious charges about her residency and where her money came from. And I think that those actually turned voters against the people that put out the PAC in favor of Mayor Reeves.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for your comments. Claire, this was something that you touched on in your recent article about the campaign and the mudslinging, was this kind of Hail Mary that Reeves seemed to throw when it seemed like the race was closing in on him.
Yes, he did. He attacked her residency, and he was ultimately unsuccessful in that attempt, and it came across to the voters as kind of an underhanded, dirty trick. And meanwhile, there was a lot of talk that he was bringing up private issues about her family life and in an attempt to sort of undermine her appearance as a person with integrity. I mean, this woman with over two decades with the FBI, an almost unimpeachable record. And it didn't go over well with the voters. I like what the caller said about the mailers. That's an interesting point. We always think of mailers as helpful, but in this case, maybe they were not. Maybe there should be some reexamination of how mailers are used and what's on them.
We've got a lot more to get to today, so I don't want to spend too much more time on this, but we also have another call here from Frank in Jacksonville. Frank, you're on the line.
Hey, this is Frank. How y'all doing today?
I'm doing great. What's your question?
Yeah, so I'm seeing all these large corporations come and just squash all these local small businesses, and I'm just kind of confused. I thought the local politicians would know for sure that my vote for Trump in this past November 8th election would mean that I'm tired of these big businesses squashing out all these small folks, you know?
Right, and you don't reside in Atlantic Beach, do you?
No, I live in Jacksonville,
okay.
Florida, actually.
Okay, well, thank you for your thoughts, Frank. Could that also be another interesting? We saw during the 2016 election, we're still getting a lot more election data coming in, AG, about what people did and how they switched their votes. For instance, we saw, I think it was about 13% of Bernie Sanders' primary voters flip and vote for Trump in the general election. What Frank kind of brings up there is the idea that maybe it isn't about party, but it's more about these local issues or big business versus small business. Do you see any of that?
No, actually, I see them as opposite phenomena. If you look at the 2016 election, a lot of the voter movement was on symbolism, it was on iconography, it was on all of these things they couldn't quite place. They didn't like Hillary Clinton, but they didn't know why, so they took a chance on Trump in many cases. Let's see how that's working out. But, you know, on the Atlantic Beach issue, I mean, these are hyper-local things. I mean, we talked about those committee mailers that came out. And, you know, one of the reasons the mailers backfire is because those are primary election tactics. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're running a Republican primary, yeah, you're going to go in. You're going to do all of that stuff. But if you're trying to appeal to NPAs, to soft Republicans, to, you know, Democrats, that's not going to fly. So I think a tactical autopsy of how Mitch Reeves lost would be instructive. And I'm not the person to do it. But, you know, if somebody took like six, you know, looked at 6 months of how Reeves ran his campaign, I mean, there's a reason he lost by 12 points, and a lot of it has to be tactical. It's not just flawed candidates, flawed candidate plus flawed tactics.
It's also possible that Frank was being ironic, considering the amount of, you know, Goldman Sachs alumni in the Trump administration. I don't want to read too much into Frank's comments, but this isn't necessarily an administration that you would consider to be the administration of small business.
Right.
You don't think Linda McMahon's enough for you?
Dan Scanlon.
My sordid past, I actually did do advertising for three election campaigns in Jacksonville, and I'm proud to say that two of those candidates won. The one thing that we realized back then, this is before this current journalism career, is that there's nothing worse than bringing in the outside guys because they don't know anything about what's happening in your district, in your city. Even worse when you have the folks who live in a small community, Beaches community, and consider the folks across the ditch, the big city, they don't want the big city to dictate things. Let's not forget Gate is actually a local corporation with a former mayor involved, but if you're living in the beach, that's across the ditch and that's big city. We don't want them here.
I remember the first time I was covering something out there and somebody at the beaches referred to the county. And I'm like, no, it's I mean, I know that, you know, you're separate in a way, but you know, we're all consolidated. not to the beaches people. Mm-hmm. It's a very real distinction.
Yeah, it's very different a lifestyle too. So our number is 549-2937. We're going to move on to another big story making headlines today. Driving some controversy is the announcement that the Duval County School Board will intend to join 10 other county school boards in filing suit against the legislature for an education train bill that passed in the waning moments of the last special legislative session. I know we shouldn't call them special anymore. They're more like extra sessions because they happen so darn often.
Or special, air quotes.
Right, special sessions. House Bill 7069 is the bill that has elicited a lot of criticism, especially because of the so-called Schools of Hope provision that speeds up the closures of failing neighborhood schools and financially incentivizing charters to open in their stead. But Duval has laid out five specific reasons with help from Jacksonville's general counsel as to why they are challenging lawmakers on this one, including Jacksonville's own Jason Fisher, a former Duval school board member himself. Tim Gibbons, charter schools, although many are run by nonprofits, are still pretty big business, and a lot of them are run by corporations. And it seems like we're seeing more and more traditional public schools being pitted against these corporations and associations, and it's pretty clear where the legislature is leaning to. Right, they're pretty much part and parcel of this national movement. Is there any fear here of retribution, further retribution from the legislature for signing on to this lawsuit? I mean, is this essentially a blacklist of 10 school districts?
I think that the school district is definitely concerned about that. One of the reasons it's, you know, number 10 on this list and not number one. But I think they're actually probably more concerned about retribution from voters. We have, 30 or so charter schools in the area, and if we call the estimate, it was something like the school district would lose some $16 million or something over 5 years because of this. School board is taking the tact that we will have our D and F schools shut down and charter schools open up, and that's going to tick a lot of people off. And if they don't do anything, they feel voters will be betrayed. Quite honestly, just to, you know, reach back a little bit to the Atlantic Beach discussion, this is a weird point in politics now where you have Republicans trying to take state control over things that historically had been local issues. And I think that this is somewhat in that same vein of a school board saying, no, this is our thing. Don't tell us how to handle this.
it's an interesting irony almost, right? Because the state legislature, they send out a lot of these memorandums about big government, especially when Barack Obama was president, about how the federal government is going in and trying to kind of erode state sovereignty. And now the same arguments are essentially being used at the local level against the state legislature about them encroaching on their rights enumerated in the Constitution. AG, what are the realistic chances of a lawsuit like this going through fast enough to overturn this legislation in the long run? I mean, is this just symbolic?
Yeah, I mean, it is a classic home rule issue, like you're pointing out. But, you know, in the discussion this week, there were board members who wondered if a lawsuit would expose the school district to retribution, if it would even be viable. I mean, it's preliminary authorization of $25,000 as part of a larger pool of, I believe it's $400,000 for a lawsuit. How far is that really going to go against the state, you know, attorney general, against, you know, the state of Florida in general? And, you know, you could definitely see retribution. I mean, Jason Fisher wants an audit of the school district because they spent $21 million over budget. You know, the school board says, well, you know, it came out of reserves. We didn't do anything, you know, irresponsible. Some programs just cost more than we thought, so we spent. But, you know, it's going to be an ongoing turf war. It's going to be something that Jason Fisher will score political points on. The school board is going to, you know, continue to be adversarial to the legislature, and it's going to hurt. And I don't know if the lawsuit can even prevail.
Dan Scanlon.
Well, you had, Michelle even had a story at 8 o'clock hour with a lawmaker who was griping about this, and he brought up 2 points. Number one, like AG just said, this is going to cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in school districts per hour, he said, you know, from a law firm working on this. So we're not going to have the money. We, the 10, are not going to have the money to handle this. And two, then that specter of outside, it's a law firm that's outside of Florida, I think was the comment, that's handling this lawsuit for these 10 districts. So what do they know?
Yeah, we've got more phone calls here, but Claire, I wanted to ask really quickly. I mean, does House Speaker Richard Corcoran's criticism of using outside legal counsel pass the smell test?
I mean, that's kind of ridiculous. You're going to try to go with the best attorney that you can find on any case. Now, this case specifically is attacking whether or not House Bill 769 violates the one subject, one bill rule. This bill is 274 pages, over 19 of which are all delineating what it's about. Now, I mean, ostensibly it's all about education, but it just covers such a vast array of subject matter that I think the lawsuit, to contradict some of the panelists today, as much as I respect y'all, I do think that the bill is the lawsuit is viable.
You don't like the idea of one subject just being stuff?
You know, it's like, yeah.
No, this stuff.
Generally education, the same things.
The fact that you know how many pages are in that bill is amazing enough. So I cede to your knowledge.
But this is not the first and will not be the last train bill that gets passed like this. And many of them don't get challenged on the single subject rule issue.
You need to watch Richard Corcoran too, because Richard Corcoran is all but running for governor right now. Mm-hmm. So he's definitely going to take a lot of positions that, you know, tune with the base. That's right. Something you want to keep in mind.
Well, we've got another call here. Mick on the north side. Mick, how are you?
Doing good. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question and comment is, teachers have a job like everybody else. Instead of suing over losing money towards charter schools, they should try to improve their teaching abilities. Because at my job, if I don't do a good job, they fire us. This is basically what the law snakes down to. They're not doing their job by raising the grades of our students, our children, so the state's going to say, hey, we're trying to teach our kids, we're going to have to take it somewhere else. So instead of suing, they should try to do their job a little better.
Thank you for that. Dan Scanlon?
I have a dear family member who actually is a teacher who teaches teachers, and this family member is constantly on the run going to schools and working with these teachers. So they are being educated. There is an ongoing training that is to keep you up to state standards and things that are happening in this legislature that they throw out. So I'll dispute that again because I know what is being done. I admit that there are teachers out there who are not per se doing their job as well as they should, but the training is there and is given to them. them.
Well, it's interesting, though, is education discussions like this oftentimes do boil down to an ideological sort of thing where you can point to bad teachers, you can point to good teachers, and I'm not saying that the facts don't matter, but there's a context around it of if you think the free market can do education better than government does, you'll use low test scores as a point in your argument, but really your argument is free market should be involved in education. And if you're in that vein, there's not much that will change your mind. So,
well, it's interesting to also note that the way teachers are graded changes drastically almost every single year, and
it keeps them on their toes.
Right.
And it frustrates them too.
Anybody want to take hold of that point here about how teachers are graded and whether or not we should be looking at these failure rates as a confirmation for whether or not a teacher is doing their job? I mean, the reality of the situation here is that teachers that are in failing schools, these schools were failing before they got in. The schools will probably be failing after, because the argument is by opponents of this legislation that you have poverty, you have property taxes, the way we fund schools and all these other things that have more to do with whether or not a school is a success rather than what the teachers are doing.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's the idea of reinforcement at home. There's the idea of, you know, cultural reinforcement in terms of, you know, are other people in the community modeling reading and learning behaviors and stuff like that. And if you don't have that, here's what happens. I mean, kids' outcome levels, they're roughly parallel until, you know, somewhere in elementary school. Then you start seeing the achievement gap grow and grow. You start seeing disengagement grow and grow. And, you know, big issue for policymakers well beyond the school district building is, you know, how to resolve that. I mean, you see it in Jacksonville with the Jacksonville Journey and, you know, how they've reached out and tried to, you know, improve outcomes for people 16 to 24 years old. So there is kind of a generational thing to solve there that, you know, school grades, teacher grades, all of these things are just one metric of a much larger and more intractable issue.
Yeah, I mean, and teachers aren't miracle workers and children aren't robots. You know, you give a teacher a classroom that's increasingly overcrowded, you take away their resources, you expect these children to pass these standardized tests that have so many criticisms that you can't even list them all in this hour. And then you want the schools to get an A every year. And I mean, you're just giving these teachers an untenable situation and then expecting them to work a miracle. Teachers are out there just like other people who work in the public service trying to do, for the most part, a good job by our children and by our communities.
Well, like the first segment, we could probably spend the entire hour on this, but we're going to move on to the last point of big news that we have set up for today. Give us a call, 549-2937. Another big story this week, the Florida Supreme Court on Thursday sided with Governor Rick Scott in ruling that he does, in fact, have the constitutional authority to strip death penalty eligible cases from Central Florida State Attorney Aramis Ayala. Of course, Ayala some months ago publicly announced her office would not seek the death penalty in cases, even if Florida's highest punishment did apply. In a 5-2 decision, justices outright rejected Ayala's argument that her own prosecutorial discretion was being sidestepped with Scott's decision to reassign 29 death penalty eligible cases from her. Justices instead found that the governor's constitutional authority clearly trumped the elected law enforcement officials. Dan Scanlon, in the last year or so, proponents of criminal justice reform have had a lot to celebrate, specifically in our area, the fact that Melissa Nelson replaced a tough-on-crime prosecutor, State Attorney Angela Corey. Ayala's now backing off from what she said since this ruling, saying now that she's going to set up a commission of some of her prosecutors to look at each case on a case-by-case basis to decide whether or not she'll apply the death penalty. That's a far cry from her stance that she had before. Is this a loss for reformists?
I don't think so. I mean, Melissa Nelson herself also stated that she was going to start reviewing many of the cases to make sure. She did announce yesterday on social media that she'd hired 10 new prosecutors. And you also have to remember, with all of the murders that we've had and homicides in Jacksonville, that the next wave after the homicide detectives get on scene are one or two assistant state attorneys, and they are part of the investigation from the start. They're not just sitting in a courtroom or sitting in their office. They're out on the scene and they get to see the same stuff as soon as the cops do. So obviously we've had some heinous crimes of late. We've had three police-involved shootings of late, two officers shot in the past week and a half. So, you know, is the death penalty warranted? I think it's worse to be sitting in a jail cell till you're 98 years old versus getting the injection. That's just my comment. I think it's worse to be stuck knowing there's nothing outside of that 8x10 wall.
All right, and we don't have a whole lot of time on this subject, unfortunately, but we do have a call coming in the meanwhile while we're figuring out whether or not we do actually indeed have a call. Anybody else want to touch this case here?
Sure.
AG.
Yeah, I think it's important to look at that panel suggestion. Rick Scott rejected it. Rick Scott said, unless you know, she fully recants her position, her opposition to pursuing the death penalty, you know, the punishment will continue. Looking at Melissa Nelson, yeah, I mean, she has proposed important reform measures, but Melissa Nelson has not ruled out the death penalty ever. Mm-hmm. I think the difference between Nelson and Corey in many ways is branding. He's using kind of mm-hmm. the right-wing friendly sort of criminal justice reform stuff. But, you know, really, it's different to presentation as much as actual enforcement policies in many ways.
There very much is a how you present it. The optics of it do matter, and there's a big difference between saying, I will never bring the death penalty versus never actually bring the death penalty, but right. not saying that. Those are two different things.
Well, we could definitely spend a lot more time on that, but unfortunately we are up against the clock. And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from the week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you now, only in Florida. Only in Florida does a man try to hide more than $1,000 in his rectum. It happened in Marion County last weekend. 26-year-old Patriot Stokes was pulled over for speeding. Nearly 200 grams of methamphetamine, some crack cocaine, heroin, and a scale were found during a search of the vehicle. They said they found a large wad of cash and some marijuana on Stokes' person. Deputies said the cash was missing by the time they got to the jail. Then they noticed $20 bills falling from Stokes' buttocks.
Make it rain.
So you were saying he was in arrears.
According to the sheriff's office, Stokes faces a list of charges, including smuggling contraband. Only in Florida.
A lot of money.
Does someone try to steal the license plate off a police cruiser while detectives are inside the vehicle? Wesley Kelly of Loxahatchee tried to do it while three Palm Beach sheriff detectives were in the car. When confronted by the officers, Kelly tried to flee and nearly hit the stolen vehicle he was driving.
Oh, no.
He then crashed through a chain link fence before he was apprehended. And lastly, only in Florida does a man get drunk and ride naked on a Walmart shopping cart.
The people of Walmart, run free!
Police in West Palm Beach arrested Jacob Steiner on Saturday for indecent exposure, disorderly intoxication, and trespassing after being warned to leave.
Did he put a towel in the seat, though?
How did
that
conversation go? He stole the shopping cart, too.
Being warned to leave. Sir, you should leave now. Please.
Please leave now. Thanks to our panel, Dan Scanlon, Timothy Gibbons, A.G. Gankarski, and Claire Goforth. We'll be right back.
Next time on 1A's Friday News Roundup, the aftermath of Harvey.
Something is significantly wrong with our command and control, and they need to stop patting each other on the back while these poor people out here waiting to be rescued.
After record rain, remarkable recoveries, and a robust relief effort, now comes the hard part. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Ken Ilgunis hikes the entire Great Plains.
I think I've trespassed across America probably more than anyone alive.
A newsman from Tampa shares some wild stories from Florida.
My favorite one is the headline, Man in Road Rage Incident Runs Over Self.
And look at the state's nobler achievements.
Did you know that we put men on the moon? And we did it from Central Florida.
On the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday mornings at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, this is John Maycumber from String Theory, and this Friday night at 11 p.m. here on WJCT, we've got a very special all-star edition of String Theory just for you. It's artists you know and love, every single track all hour long. We'll be spotlighting great music from Ray Davies of the Kinks, Delbert McClinton, Keb Moe, Bonnie Raitt, Anita Franco, and yeah, even those four guys from Liverpool, the Beatles. You'll hear them too this Friday night at 11 p.m. on our all-star edition of String Theory. It's one full hour of the very best of modern acoustic and Americana music. This at every Friday night at 11 p.m. right here on 89.9 WJCT and WJCT.org. Strum along, sing along, or just kick back and listen. But make sure you join us for String Theory this Friday night at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT and WJCT.org. Your community, your world.
Welcome back. It's a festival. It's a festive way to connect St. Augustine residents to their city's Spanish history. The Spanish Wine Festival is coming up next weekend in the nation's oldest city. Not only will you enjoy Spanish wine, cuisine, and culture, which you could make the argument you already can in St. Augustine, but this is going to be much bigger than that, you'll help raise money for some local charities. One of them is Canines for Warriors. Eric Heineman is executive director for Canines for Warriors and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. And actually, it's Canines United.
Canines United. I apologize for that. Canines
no
United.
Worries. We actually get that a little bit here.
It gets a little mixed up every once in a while.
Yes.
Especially because we have a community that is so focused on our veterans and our current serving people that there's a lot of organizations. But I want you to explain to me the history of Canines United and tell us a little bit about what you do, and then we'll get into the festival.
Sure. So Canines United, we do things a little bit different than Canines Warriors in the fact that we actually serve the canines of law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
These units tend to be some of the more expensive units in law enforcement, but they tend to be the least funded.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of budgetary constraints and things of that nature. So we really want to fill the gaps. And so in doing so, what we want to do is make sure that the canines and the handlers themselves receive the tools that they can do their job effectively, efficiently, and safely while protecting our community.
And that's for those that are currently serving
in
law enforcement. And so What are some of the issues specific to these handlers of these dogs? What is it that they need, and what aren't they getting because of budget constraints?
Sure. So sometimes it can be additional training. So there's some really good training that they do need to go through, but there's some much more intense, specialized training that they can go through, so they can learn more. Different techniques, things that are going on, new technologies, things of that nature to sort of help do their job and help their canine partner efficiently do their job as well. In fact, we're sending two JSO officers to Orlando later this month for some of that specialized training.
So can you kind of tell me a little bit about, maybe give me a couple of examples of what that specialized training looks like? I mean, what are we hoping these handlers and these canine law enforcement officers learn?
Well, just like any other industry, there's always new techniques and new ways of, let's say it's a drug sniffing dog. There might be different techniques to training the dog, to keeping the dog ready, willing, and able to perform when they're called upon. There's might be different types of resources, different types of equipment that they can use. And so there'll be vendors there that talk about that type of equipment and things of that nature as well. So it's really just making sure that these law enforcement officers are On the cutting edge of technology and information.
And, you know, it's worthy to mention, too, that maybe people don't think about this. Obviously, we know our human officers kind of go into the line of duty every single day. It's a very dangerous job. But on top of that, they build a relationship with these dogs, and these dogs are just as much at risk as these officers, as we saw very recently. And there's a relationship that your organization has with a JSO canine officer that was recently wounded. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, Jeremy Mason was shot in the face while pursuing a known suspect, bank robber. And it was really, it really hit home. These officers and their canine partners are like family to us. And it's not just local. We definitely support our local organization departments, and that's where most of our funding goes to. So we really build these relationships. When we have events, a lot of times these canine officers with their canine partner will come out and do meet and greets with those people that want to come out to the events and things of that nature. And so we really get to know them on a personal level, especially our founder, Debbie Johnson, who's been doing this since obviously day one, almost 3 years ago, and has just really, really, some of these officers have come to her home and they just really get to know her really, really well.
Now, it's the recovery effort for that officer in particular that you'll be raising some money for with this relationship that you have to the Spanish food, Spanish Wine Festival. But there's a lot more that you're going to do with that relationship. Can you tell me a little bit about how Canines United got involved with the Spanish Wine Festival in the first place?
Yeah, so the Spanish Wine Festival wants to promote and support local charities. So, and on a diverse, wide range as well. So they want to. So there's a couple different other organizations that help children that are on the dock as well, and they definitely feel that the law enforcement is really important to our community. So. The board had decided that no better charity than this one, who really spends almost every single dollar that they raise going back to the law enforcement officers or to the canines.
Now, if somebody wanted to get involved with Canines United, maybe not necessarily become part of the staff, but to volunteer or to donate or to even volunteer specifically during the Spanish Wine Festival, what can they do? Any member of the public?
Yeah, so they can definitely go to our website. That's www.caninesunited.com or .org. That's canines.united.org. Or they can even email us at events@caninesunited.org for more information on that as well.
All right. Well, Eric Heinemann is the executive director for Canines United, excuse me again. And the Spanish Wine Festival is next weekend, correct?
It is. It is. And this is our second year doing it. We're a little more involved this year than we were last year in trying to sell tickets and really get the hype going up. And one of the most wonderful things about this particular event is that through the generosity of the sponsors, like Wells Fargo, they actually pay for all our all the equipment, all the things that need to be done. And so every single dollar of the ticket sales – go back to the charities. So not just a portion, but every single dollar. And you mentioned JSO. They have, we're going to give 10% of those proceeds for sure back to JSO and their canine unit.
Well, thank you, Eric Heinemann. And we will be back in just a moment.
Hurricane Harvey broke major rainfall records this week, but did it also set a new normal for major weather events in the era of climate change? I'm Ira Flatow. On the next Science Friday, we look at what to expect from hurricanes and monsoons now that sea temperatures are rising. Plus, some builders are ready for the next flood. How to build flood-resilient cities of the future on the next Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Next time on 1A's Friday News Roundup, the aftermath of Harvey.
Something is significantly wrong with our command and control, and they need to stop patting each other on the back while these poor people out here waiting to be rescued.
After record rain, remarkable recoveries, and a robust relief effort, now comes the hard part. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele inviting you to join us this weekend for a Prairie Home Companion from the famed Fitzgerald Theater in downtown St. Paul. Our guests include Lucius, Mr. Brad Meldow, and comic Tom Papa. Plus our acting company, Serena Brooks, Sue Scott, Tim Russell, and sound effects man Fred Newman. My Song of the Week, our First Call radio players, and much, much more.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back, and finally this hour, Jacksonville singer-songwriter Jenny Reed is out with a new album and a new sound. Radio Silence is billed as a step away from her usual acoustic pop style. The album drops next week, but we've got a preview right now live in studio. Jenny Reed, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So really quickly here, can you tell me a little bit about your journey with music and why this particular sound is a departure for you?
Well, I had the chance to work with a friend of mine who has been asking me to play with her for a long time, and she is very deep in the EDM, so I was definitely a little shy to get into that with her. Right. And I went through, you know, a life-changing situation, and it was just the perfect time to open up my musical adventures to that, and it turned out being a really cool thing where I got to mix my acoustic pop love with her EDM love, so...
That's interesting. Well, you know, I also see that you have some accolades here, some experience that you have with some TV shows, specifically one that when I was younger, I was really obsessed with, which is One Tree Hill. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
So I was a huge fan of One Tree Hill when I was younger. Still am, I'm sure, I guess. And I was really into acting, and I still am here and there. And I was an extra on the show a lot. And then, like, one day I was like, I want to do more than be an extra. So I started this campaign, and eventually the creators reached out, and I got to do a scene of Tyler Hilton, one of my favorite musicians.
So before you play a song for us, can you tell us where fans and our listeners here at WJCT who may not know can go online and catch your newest music?
Yeah, it'll be out next Saturday, September 9th. It'll be on every single music store online that you can find, including www.jennyreedmusic.com.
All right. Well, do you have something to play for us?
Yeah, I'm going to play one of my new songs called Run, a little bit of an acoustic version. But
okay, sure. Go ahead.
Watch you going to my house, you, that's right, I don't care, baby, just remember, when you look back, no, I won't be there, yeah, it's all so what was left here. You can run, but I won't be chasing, you can run, but I won't be chasing, no, no, no. You can run, baby, yeah, I ooh, run, you can run, baby, yeah, I ooh. Made your choice, and now I have to live with it. You get mad and add me to the list of the girls who wouldn't put up with it. Run, you can run, baby, yeah, I ooh, run, you can run, baby, yeah, I ooh, and maybe I'll lose some sleep tonight, but who needs sleep when it's chasing me when I'm back on my feet? Run, you can run, baby, yeah, I ooh, run. So just run, baby, run, 'cause I won't be chasing you.
Jenny Reed, thank you for coming to First Coast Connect. And that's our show for today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. The show's producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board. I'm Ryan Bankin for Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville.
Support
your community, your world.
First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.